Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to early release and ad-free episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe in Apple Podcasts. Videos of our Thursday release episodes between the madness are available on YouTube and Spotify. We've got all the links in our episode notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
In Woodland Hills, an upscale, quiet corner of Los Angeles' San Fernando Valley, Fabio Cementelli pulled his Ford pickup truck into the parking lot of a Vietnamese restaurant. It was Sunday evening, January 22, 2017, and the 49-year-old celebrity hairstylist had been sent on an errand by his wife Monica to pick up dinner. After parking at the shopping center, he turned off the engine and walked inside. Minutes later, he came out carrying containers of soup. Once back in his truck, he pulled out of the lot and drove home to his wife and his two teenage daughters. A completely ordinary errand on a completely ordinary evening. Except, it wasn't ordinary at all. Fabio had no idea he was being watched the whole time. That someone had been sent to that very parking lot at that very time with a single job: to kill him. But something went wrong and the mission was aborted. Fabio drove home, oblivious to what was happening, and sat down to dinner with his family. He'd been given a reprieve, one more night with the people he loved. But the people who wanted him dead weren't finished, and they'd try again the next day. Join me now as we dive into the sinister murder of Fabio Cementelli, a beauty industry icon whose life was cut short in a crime that would take years to fully unravel. You'll hear how a brutal stabbing, staged to look like a home invasion, would send detectives down a trail of blood, betrayal, and buried secrets. And how 7 years later, a cold case detective would finally uncover the missing piece that broke the case wide open. Sixteen-year-old Isabella Cementelli left school at 3 p.m. on Monday, January 23, 2017. The drive to her home usually took about 30 minutes, an upscale neighborhood where entertainment executives live behind hedges and privacy fences. But today, Isabella wasn't heading home. She had a 4 o'clock job interview at a deli near her school. When she arrived, the interview was almost over as soon as it began, and she got the job.
I was going to go straight home. My mom called me and said that my prescription glasses were ready and that I could go pick it up. And I asked if I needed someone to come with me, like an adult, because I was 16. And she said she would call them and then call me back to let me know. She called me back and said I can go pick it up myself and then come home. From where I was on the freeway, it was probably 15 minutes to get there, and then I picked up my glasses.
After picking up her glasses, Isabel arrived at her home at exactly 4:54 p.m.
I parked on the street outside of my house. That's usually where I parked. I would enter the garage key code, and the garage would open, and then I would go through the door that leads to the kitchen.
But as Isabella walked up the driveway, she noticed something strange.
The garage was already open. It surprised me because usually the garage door and the gate are closed, but every once in a while someone will forget to shut it on their way out. So it was unusual, yeah. So I went through the garage into the door that leads to the kitchen. When you open the door, there's a big window in the kitchen that you can see outside. So I opened the door and I saw him, what looked like him, to just be sitting outside.
Isabella's father, Fabio, was exactly where she expected to see him, on his favorite chair on the back patio. But almost immediately, she could see that something terrible had happened.
There was blood all over the kitchen. As I was walking in, I noticed it on the floor, on the walls, on the door, and it smelled like vinegar. I didn't even go outside. I just called 911 right away. I just dropped my stuff, and then I went outside after.
When Isabella reached the patio, she found her father slumped forward, his chest and head resting against the seat of the patio chair. Blood pooled on the ground around him. He'd been stabbed multiple times.
Well, at first they told me to turn him on his back, but I was by myself at that point. My mom hadn't come home yet, and I was trying. And I even said on the call, I can't do it. He's too heavy for me to do it. And then shortly after, my mom came and she opened the door to the backyard, which is where I was, and just was yelled what happened and screaming. And I told her, they're telling me to put him on his back, and she was trying to help me. I was just in shock. I was crying, but then I wasn't crying. I was trying to be responsible. I was trying to help my mom. It's all over the place. So,
fire and EMS arrived at the Cementilli home just after 5 p.m., and Fabio was soon pronounced dead at the scene. Officer Gabriel Rebelato of the LAPD was the first police officer to arrive at the Cementilli residence.
We walked up to the residence, met with one of the firefighters. I asked, so what do we have? And he responded, the bodies in the backyard.
As he entered the home, this scene told its own grim story.
As I walked into the garage, I noticed there was blood stains on the floor, and then there was an open door leading into the residence from the garage. As I walked in, it led into the kitchen. It appeared to be footprints with blood. So as soon as I walked in, I observed the footprints, walked around the island, and firefighter indicated that the wife and the victim's children were sitting at the dining table. I heard them crying. I remember her saying, why would somebody do this to him?
Seated at the dining table was Fabio's wife, Monica Cementilli, their 18-year-old daughter, Jessica, and Isabella.
I exited the residence into the patio area. I remember seeing the victim with his chest and his head resting on the seat of a patio chair. He had blood around his neck and blood on the floor.
Fabio had suffered 7 stab wounds, a swift, targeted, and brutal attack. As Officer Rebelato escorted the family out of the residence, something else caught his attention.
So as we were walking out from the dining area to the front, I was walking behind the family and I observed on the left-hand side of the front door, there was a hallway leading into what appeared to be a room. I noticed there was like open drawer and items scattered on the floor. It didn't appear like it was anything else that had been, I guess, tampered with.
The primary bedroom had been ransacked, drawers pulled out, items scattered on the floor. On its face, this looked like a home invasion robbery gone wrong. But Detective Ryan Verna noticed a few things that didn't fit this theory.
Fabio appeared to have a very nice watch on his left wrist. Well, if you're in a house looking for expensive property to take, an expensive watch would be an important thing to take, I would imagine.
The watch on Fabio's wrist was an $8,000 Rolex, not something a burglar would leave behind. And then there was something else. Blood had been tracked all throughout the ransacked bedroom.
It appeared based on that the ransacking had occurred after the murder.
During the murder, Fabio's Porsche had been stolen from the garage, but was later recovered about 5 miles away, abandoned, with blood droplets on the interior. As for the family's whereabouts that day, Monica had been shopping, Jessica had been babysitting, and of course, Isabella had been at the optometrist. In the days that followed, detectives made another discovery. The DVR unit from the Cementilli home surveillance system was missing. That also meant that any footage it might have captured was also gone. But detectives canvassed the neighborhood for other surveillance footage, and what they found was shocking. A camera from a nearby residence captured two men jogging up the street toward the Cementelli home, wearing baggy sweatpants and hoodies, their faces completely covered. The footage also captured Fabio's Porsche leaving the residence at 4:53 p.m., exactly 1 minute before Isabella arrived home. Who were these two men, and why had they killed Fabio Cementelli? Was this really a burglary gone wrong, or something far more sinister? Mariella Cementelli, Fabio's older sister, later reflected on their early years growing up in Toronto.
We're from Canada, Toronto. We were born in the city of Toronto. My mother, myself, my sister, and father were born in Italy. Fabio was the only one born in Canada. We lost our father at a very young age. My brother was 9, I was 13, and my sister was 16. He was 39 when he passed, and my mom became our supporter. My mom, with basic education, worked 3 jobs to support us. We used to carry a key around our neck on a rope to go to school and take care of ourselves. Our older sister used to oversee us and made sure we ate, but my mom worked all the time. We were always supporting each other the best we can.
In the years that followed, their mother held the family together through sheer force of will, and her children absorbed the lessons she lived every day.
He first had a newspaper job at 13, and then he worked at a supermarket stocking shelves at 16. And around 17, he used to also help with the veterans' banquet hall as well, washing pots and pans.
Fabio's work ethic was already clear, so when Mariella later opened up her own salon, bringing him in felt like a natural step.
I owned a salon as early as 83. He was working for me part-time, and then he loved it, and he was very, very talented, and he decided to go to hairdressing school. After he had his own salon, we felt we were far apart and we can consolidate, so we went into business together in 2001 called Salon Shampoo. We would train for competitively to be in competitions all over the world. We traveled together and we would compete and create creations like wonderful, beautiful hair. In within 7 minutes, they would say go and then stop. And then the judges would come around and look at your model. And then we would all wait for the awards ceremony. And Fabio and I did very well in those arenas. Fabio won in Las Vegas. He won in Germany. I won in a few myself. And we just really were a very strong team. And because of that, a lot of hair color companies were always asking us to endorse their product. And so we gladly did so. And we continued to do a lot of educational work on platforms because we were up on a riser. And people would come to our classes and learn the newest tricks and tips in the hair industry. And we just kept getting huge numbers at our events.
Along the way, Fabio married and had a son, Luigi. But eventually, a young beautician named Monica caught his eye.
She worked in a clothing boutique 3 doors down from the salon, Modelli. She was doing nails and makeup upstairs on the second floor.
An affair with Monica led to Fabio's divorce in 1995. 2 years later, he married her and had 2 daughters, Jessica and Isabella. In 2007, the family relocated from Toronto to Los Angeles when Wella, one of the world's largest salon color companies, recruited Fabio. 3 years later, he was promoted to creative director for Wella North America, and by 2013, he'd risen to vice president of education. Through the years, Fabio and his sister Mariella remained close, professionally and personally. But that all came crashing down in January 2017.
It was 9 o'clock on Monday night, January the 23rd, and I got a phone call. And I was the head of this project that we were working on, so I avoided the call. And then I got a call again within the next minute, and so I answered the call. And it was Monica calling, saying, "They killed Fabio. They killed Fabio." And then the phone was cracking up, and then I was like, it doesn't even sound like her. I'm like, this is a crazy joke. And then Jessica came on the phone. She goes, "Zia," like auntie, "Daddy's dead. Someone killed Daddy." And it was blood everywhere, and she started breaking down, and then I'm breaking down, and I'm like, this can't be true.
Mariella flew to Los Angeles for the wake, organized by Wella and held at the Cimentelli house. About 80 people attended, including family, friends, and colleagues from the beauty industry. According to Mariella, Monica wasn't feeling up to making an appearance that evening and went to her bedroom. She then changed into pajamas, indicating she preferred some space. But then, something unexpected happened.
I got tapped on the shoulder by Deborah Obad and said, "You got to help me. You got to help me get this guy out of here." And I turned around and I said, "Who?" And then we got closer to where Monica was sitting. And I noticed she had her makeup on, her hair was down, and she was dressed up again. And there was this guy, the two of them were like kind of leaning into each other. And they were talking like they were in their own little world in the backyard, not far from where Fabio was murdered. I was shocked because she looked like she was done for the day. And then she popped back out again. I think Deborah was the one who asked them that we need to go inside. And then all four of us went through the kitchen door.
Monica went inside the living room and sat on the couch.
I whispered into Monica's ear. I go, "Who is this guy? Like, you know, everybody's looking at you. Everybody's watching. What's going on?" In Italian, because I didn't want to embarrass her or him or my brother. Like, this is embarrassing. She's acting like she's in her own little world, talking to some strange guy. I just didn't like that. It was very not right to be doing, disrespectful. She was, this is my racquetball coach, Robert Baker. This is my sister-in-law, Mariella. And we shook hands. He gave me his condolences. And then she introduced him to Deborah. And then I think I heard her say, "You probably better you go now." So he got up, she got up, we all got up. And as we're walking towards the front door, Monica's mother is standing there looking at him with her eyes beady. And then as he was leaving, he wanted to nod and say goodnight. And she told him, very loud in English, late 60s, 70s age woman. And then she just screamed out off like that to him.
The family wondered why Monica's racquetball coach was even at Fabio's wake. Something about the whole encounter felt deeply wrong. And there was one other detail that stuck with them. Robert Baker had a bandage on his finger. Everyone grieves differently. It's something people say all the time, and it's true. Still, in the days following Fabio's murder, Monica's actions stood out to his family. Fabio's son from his first marriage, Luigi Cimentelli, was in Canada when he received the news.
"I was in grad school at Brock University. I had just finished the first semester and was ready to begin second semester. And that's when I received the phone call the night of the murder."
Luigi says the call came from his sister, Jessica. And in those first moments, the situation felt almost impossible to process.
"My sister, Jessica, was freaking out, said someone killed Dad, and just sort of being hysterical. I think what I said, just not taking in the information, was, 'Let me talk to Dad.' And then I think she hung up the phone. I hung up and then tried my dad's line. No answer. And then I believe I had gotten a call back from Jessica's number."
In those frantic early moments, Jessica's phone was passed between family members as they tried to make sense of what had happened. But then, Monica's friend Deborah came on the line, and the tone of the conversation shifted.
Deborah came on the phone with me. She said to me, Monica's freaking out about money, worried that they're not going to have money, and that there's money coming to me, and so that I would help them with the money that I was to receive, because they need the help. And that I was to get money, therefore, the presumption was that I was going to give them money to help. Deborah was like, don't worry, he'll give it to you, basically very presumptuously, and then relaying it to me and saying, you got to help them out, they're going to need help with money. As soon as the phone was passed to Monica and we spoke for the first time after the murder, the first words out of her mouth were regarding life insurance money. She says, there's money coming to you, you'll be able to buy a house, you'll be able to buy a car. Yeah, that was the topic of conversation. Lots of life insurance was up for grabs here. That was the message that was given. The night of the murder, that was the only topic of conversation.
For Monica, money seemed to be the only topic of interest. And in the days and weeks that followed, it stayed that way, including one incident Luigi remembered from his father's wake.
So when she printed out the document, she was showing it to me. It was just me and her up there. She was looking at it, looking down, smiling at it, and even in the strange way, petting this piece of paper, just looking at it as though it was some precious thing that she was holding onto in her hands, kind of moving her hand across it. Sounds silly, but I know what I saw. I was being shown this document, and I was being shown, look at how fantastically large all of these numbers are. Isn't this great? That's what happened. I would say 75% of every conversation was about money. And not just money in general, but specifically about the life insurance.
According to Luigi, the next 5 months brought more of the same. Every time he spoke to Monica, the conversation turned to money. Specifically, the life insurance policies, totaling approximately $1.6 million.
You know, at the time, when you're grieving like that, you know, you don't put those pieces together immediately, right? It's a lot easier to do that after the fact.
Meanwhile, detectives with the LAPD were busy investigating every lead, and fairly early on, they caught a major break. Forensic testing of the blood evidence at the scene revealed two contributors, Fabio and an unknown individual. When the second sample was analyzed, it immediately matched an individual already in their database, Robert Baker, Monica's racquetball coach, the same man who'd shown up at the wake with a bandaged finger. In 1993, Robert was convicted on 6 counts, including lewd and lascivious acts on a child under 14. The victim, his own stepdaughter. After serving his time and being released, Baker then entered into a domestic partnership with the victim, who was now an adult. Essentially, he went on to marry his own stepdaughter. In a disturbing turn, the woman, later known as Devin Michaels, would eventually have her own criminal case, one we covered in the previous episode. Years later, Devin married her former stepson before killing his father and is now serving life in prison. By 2015, Baker had been largely out of work for several years. Nearly broke, he took a job as a racquetball coach at an LA fitness gym in the West Hills area. It was there, in December of 2015, that he first met Monica Cementelli. Detectives learned that Robert and Monica had been having an affair since early 2016, about a year before Fabio's murder. And as Detective Chris Gable dug deeper, the picture became increasingly damning for them both.
We learned about Robert Baker and his DNA being found at the crime scene. We learned that he was a 296 registrant. He had about 10 years of military service. We learned that there was a secret affair between Monica Cementelli and Robert Baker, and that he was her racquetball coach. They had set up and started surveillance on them. And at that point, they decided to withhold the information to Monica about the DNA. We wanted them to maintain the impression that they were still working it as a burglary gone bad. And we did not want them to reveal the DNA results. We wanted them to continue to trickle it out. And that was at our direction when we wanted more to come out. While they were doing that, at our end, we were gathering more information. Social media, call detail records, all that kind of stuff. So we're writing search warrants and getting all that stuff so we could learn the background better.
Police secretly placed tracking devices on Monica and Robert's vehicles, with surveillance teams tracking them for months. During that time, detectives observed the pair go on dates, kiss openly in public, and take luxury trips to Las Vegas, all while Monica presented herself to her family as a grieving widow. Cell phone records from the year before Fabio's murder showed the two were exchanging as many as 5,000 messages a month. And when investigators reviewed the content, the nature of the relationship became clear. Hundreds of sexually explicit photos indicating the affair had been ongoing both before and after Fabio's death. Some of the most explicit images were sent to Robert while Monica was in Toronto for Fabio's funeral. On June 16th, 2017, nearly 5 months after the murder, police pulled over Monica's black Ford Mustang with Baker at the wheel. Both were taken into custody in connection with Fabio's murder. In the back of the squad car, Monica leaned toward Baker and whispered, "Don't talk." But even from jail, their relationship didn't fade. It intensified. The two exchanged hundreds of letters, with Monica signing her as Mrs. Baker, Monica Baker, and your wifey, often adding explicit drawings. Detectives later arranged 6 recorded encounters between the two in adjoining holding cells. On the tapes, they flirted, stripped for each other, and engaged in sexual behaviors. During one recording, Baker proposed marriage. Through tears, Monica said yes. After 7 long years of delays, Robert Baker finally pleaded no contest to the charges in 2023, and he was immediately sentenced to life without parole. But this was not an overdue admission of guilt. Instead, Robert appeared to have a plan, one to set Monica free. From the moment he entered his plea, Baker insisted Monica had nothing to do with the murder. According to him, she didn't participate and had no idea it was going to happen. Prosecutors understood immediately that Robert's testimony could undermine their case against Monica if the jury believed him. But investigators soon discovered what they believed was the final missing piece of the puzzle. Remember the joggers seen near Fabio's home on the day of the murder? There were 2, and so far, only one of them had been identified, apprehended, and arrested. The renewed push to identify the second person fell to veteran LAPD cold case investigator Mitzi Roberts, known within the department for her relentless approach to unsolved cases. Her work later inspired Michael Connelly's best-selling detective character, Renee Ballard.
The case when I came on was solved. I had 2 focuses, one to carry the case through the court's process on the individuals that were in custody, and the second was to try to identify and arrest the third suspect.
Robert says the trail wasn't easy to follow.
Because there was a lot of use of burner phones and things such as that to sort of make it difficult for me. It took a while. Initially, we started with looking at things that sort of stood out to us as out of the ordinary. We looked at many individuals, starting out with where did Robert Baker go on the day right after the murder? Who did he contact? Who did he call? Who did he have conversations with? And through that investigation, there were several names that came up.
Like any good Nancy Drew detective story, the journey to solving the mystery began with a single clue.
We found a Facebook message that was sent on, I believe it was January 25th, from Robert Baker's Facebook account to an individual named Christopher Austin. And when I started looking into that, it was very rare that they communicated via the Facebook Messenger app. So we started to look into Christopher Austin as a suspect at that time.
It was a long shot, but it was the only real lead she had.
Initially, we looked into Christopher Austin. The information I had at the time was that he lived in Fayetteville. And so we wrote a search warrant for flight manifests to see if we could determine if Christopher Austin flew to the LA area during the time period of the murder. Via cell phone records, we knew that Robert Baker was in the area of Los Angeles International Airport on January 22nd, 2017, between the hours of 7 and 8 in the morning.
Cell phone location data showed that on the morning before the murder, Robert Baker picked someone up from the airport, then dropped someone off at the airport bus terminal afterward. Mitzi reviewed flight records between North Carolina and Los Angeles from the day surrounding the killing. When Christopher Austin's name didn't appear, it seemed like a dead end. But months later, buried in the case files, she found the break she'd been missing. A phone number linked to a burner phone Baker had been using.
I wanted to see who was the first person that Robert Baker had contact with on this burner phone. Because when you get a burner phone, it's so that you can talk to people that you don't want law enforcement typically to know you're talking to. And when I ran the number, I found that it was another prepaid burner phone that was purchased in Anchorage, Alaska. And that was a big find for me because when I was doing the research into Christopher Austin and I couldn't connect him coming to the States from Fayetteville, and then I remember doing some more research into him, and I was like, well, he doesn't even live in Fayetteville. He lives in Anchorage. And so that's what kind of led me off of him. But when I found out that there was now this prepaid burner phone that somebody had purchased in Anchorage, Alaska, that was the only name in my investigation that I knew to Alaska.
It turned out Mitzi had been searching the wrong haystack. All this time, she should have been looking for flights from Alaska, not North Carolina.
I wrote a series of search warrants to the airlines trying to find a manifest that had Christopher on it coming into LAX on January 22nd during the time period where we know that Robert Baker picked somebody up. And Alaskan Airlines attached a flight manifest that had him leaving Anchorage, Alaska very early in the morning of the 22nd, making a connection through Seattle and landing in LAX at around 7:30 in the morning.
That was it. This was what police had been searching for 7 years.
On the day of the murder, on the 23rd at about 11 at night, he was at LAX. He went up to the ticket counter and actually paid $180 to switch his ticket and fly out that evening. We know that his flight landed back in Anchorage in the early morning of the 24th.
Further investigation revealed that Christopher Austin had received money from one of Robert Baker's bank accounts in the days following the murder. Detectives also learned he was living in Vancouver, Washington. With that information, authorities there had enough to move in and arrest him.
I was on my way to work. I got pulled over. I was being followed too close. I tried to get out of their way, but when they got right behind me, I felt like I was getting ready to get pulled over. And I was like, well, maybe I was driving a little faster than I should have been. And then they pulled me over, told me I had a warrant for my arrest. I was a little shocked. And then they pulled me out of the car, handcuffed me, and put me in the back of the patrol car.
Once in custody, it didn't take long for Chris to confess to everything.
And then I remember him showing me the pictures. He said, we know you were there. So you need to be honest with us. He showed me pictures of Mr. Baker and myself jogging and a black Porsche. I told him I was there. I told him that I hoped. I told him that I stabbed him once. That's what I told him.
Christopher Austin's father had been a childhood best friend to Robert Baker in North Carolina and grew up calling Robert uncle. Over the years, Robert took him under his wing, finding him jobs and bringing him to Las Vegas and Los Angeles for extended stays. Eventually, Christopher grew tired of the lifestyle and moved to Alaska to get away. But in 2016, Christopher received an unexpected phone call.
Baker told me she's loaded, she wants him gone, she's gonna get paid. Baker told me, I'm gonna get you a ticket, it should be fine. It's just a job, and there's plenty of money. Once she gets this insurance money, we're gonna be good.
Robert was asking Chris to help him kill somebody, the husband of his mistress. Eventually, he talked Christopher into it and flew him to Los Angeles on January 22, 2017. During his confession, Christopher told detectives something they'd never known before. The original plan was to kill Fabio on the 22nd, the night before the murder.
As the night fell, he let me know. He said, she's going to send him to the store so we can catch him then. And I just said, okay. And then we went to the shopping center. We parked out back. He showed me a picture of him. He said, this is who you're looking for. He should be in a blue or black Ford pickup. And I said, okay. Then he parked out back and he made me get out of the car, and then he moved the car somewhere else. And I walked along, and as I'm walking, I was like, I'm not doing this. And I saw him, like, I can't do this. And I went back to the car. He's like, what happened? So I was like, couldn't get him, can't do it. We left and went back to his apartment. I watched TV and went to sleep.
According to Christopher Austin, Robert remained in constant communication with Monica throughout the plan, providing Fabio's location and the family schedule, while Robert handled the rest. Detectives then worked to corroborate the key details. The Vietnamese restaurant Chris described matched Monica's order records. Fabio's phone then placed them there at the same time. Robert Baker's phone did as well. Investigators believed the level of detail would have been difficult to fabricate without firsthand knowledge. After the failed attempt, Austin said he thought the plan was over. The next day, Robert told him otherwise.
It wasn't until later that day where he said, she's going to go to the store and he's going to be home alone. That's what he told me. It was a text he got. He kind of jolted. He said, yo, she's home. He's home alone. He said, what if I go and you just come with me?
Christopher agreed. They put on baggy sweatpants and hoodies and drove across town, then parked about a mile from the Cementelli house and jogged the rest of the way.
Gave me the knife. He looked at me, he said, are you with me? And like a dummy, I said, yeah, and I just followed him. When we got to the driveway, he said the door should be open. He opened the front door and I followed him in. And in the hallway of the entrance of the door, he said he should be out back. He told me to stay low. And he creeped ahead and made sure he wasn't seen. And then he opened the door. He said, on the count of three, he's gonna hold him down. And he opened the door and he held his mouth, couldn't scream. And he started stabbing him. And he started stabbing him once. And then he left, started running to the house and told me to go get in the car because he knew the car was in the garage.
According to Christopher, the front door of the house had been left unlocked, deliberately, by Monica. After the killing, Robert drove Christopher to the bus terminal for the airport in a rental car.
I told him, I can't believe you had me do that. I'm never going to see you again. And then he was like, you're good. Like, you're still a good person. I was like, I'm not a good person. Then he said, don't worry about it. She wanted him dead. It's done. Don't worry about it. You're still a good person. He couldn't convince me that I was.
In the wake of his 2024 confession, Christopher Austin pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and the personal use of a knife. He was sentenced to 16 years to life in prison for his role in the murder of Fabio Cementelli. Christopher and Robert were now both behind bars, but for Fabio's family, the fight was only half over. The investigation, Robert's plea, Christopher's confession, all of that had been building towards something bigger. After 7 agonizing years of grief and unanswered questions, the moment Fabio's family had been waiting for was finally within reach. Monica Cementelli was going on trial for murder. Monica's trial began in January 2025, 8 years after Fabio's murder. Over the course of 29 days, the prosecution laid out its case against Monica, arguing that Monica was the driving force behind the murder conspiracy, that she'd enlisted Robert Baker to kill her husband, and deliberately created a window of time on the day of the murder when Fabio would be alone in the house.
This guy is not capable of setting this whole thing up. There has to be brains behind this. No one's ever said the defendant isn't smart or cunning or manipulative, because that's exactly what she is. For Robert Baker to figure this out, he needed to know the timing. He needed to know when he could go there. He needed to be told, like Austin told you, when to go. It's go time. Let's go. Remember how he hurried up Austin? He said, let's go. Austin told you. He said, let's go. We gotta go. It was a rush because that window was small. And that's the whole point. Remember, this murder wasn't supposed to happen on the 23rd. So that's the new game changer. There's a new plan. Jessica would be babysitting that Monday at 4. She knew Bella had an interview at 4, and she made herself unavailable at 4 and out of the house. The window was 4. He's jogging up the hill at 4:18. Furthermore, he had to know he could get in the house. What was his plan? What was his plan if all the doors are locked? Did anyone ever think about that? If the defendant had nothing to do with this, what happens when you get there and all the doors are locked? As Austin told you, she said to him, the front door will be unlocked, and they went right through the front door.
The evidence showed that Monica and Robert had been in near constant contact throughout the day of the murder using encrypted phone apps. Location data also revealed them together at LA Fitness a few hours before the murder. But investigators say the most striking detail came later. Records indicated that Monica and Robert met face-to-face around 3 p.m., while she was reportedly shopping at Target.
And it did work. The window was tight. They executed it. They murdered Fabio. They got away. And then Isabella came home, and she came home right after. She did let her daughter find her dad. And that's something that you should really think about. What kind of person does that?
But the defense maintained there was no proof Monica had known or participated in the murder conspiracy. Their star witness, of course, was Robert Baker himself, who testified that Monica was completely innocent.
But we're not here to decide whether or not Monica Cimentilli was a bad wife, an adulteress. We're here to decide, you are here to decide, if she's been proven guilty of first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder beyond a reasonable doubt. Maybe they just wanted her because they realized if it wasn't for her, Baker would not have been in her life. If it wasn't for her, Fabio Cimentilli would be alive today. For that, she is responsible and will live for that for the rest of her life. But adultery is not murder. We know Austin, we know Baker did that. Monica was not part of that, nor have they proven she is part of that.
While much of the evidence regarding Monica's actions on the day of the murder was circumstantial, Christopher's testimony and the corroborating evidence about the attempted attack the night before were presented by prosecutors as particularly strong. They argued the events described would have been difficult to carry out without her direct involvement. Robert's credibility was further challenged at trial by a recorded jail conversation played for the jury. Whispering to each other inside a holding cell, the jury heard Robert tell Monica, "I'll take it to my grave, baby. I love you. I'll take the blame for everything. I'll lie and take it. I will lie to get you out of this if I have to."
After she's been told that Robert Baker's DNA has been found all over her house, she's still continuing this because she's been in on it the whole time. She's so detached from the murder of Fabio when it happens because it's already been in motion. This has been her goal. This is a good time for her. That's why you see her out celebrating with Robert Baker. She's the opposite of mourning. Now she's closer to that goal of getting what she's wanted for all these months, to be Mrs. Baker. How much more evidence do you have to see to know that she wanted to be Mrs. Baker? That was her ultimate goal. She wasn't happy with how things were. Fabio was the barrier to that happiness.
After almost 40 days of trial, the jury deliberated for nearly 9 hours before reaching its verdict.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Monica Cimentelli, guilty of the crime of murder, a felony, as charged in count one of the indictment. We further find the murder to be of the first degree. We further find the allegation that the murder of Fabio Cimentelli was intentional and carried out by the defendant, Monica Cimentelli, for financial gain.
For her role in the murder of her husband, Monica Cimentelli was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. For Fabio's family, the verdict brought something close to relief. Not peace, not closure, but the certainty that the truth had finally been spoken out loud. Because alongside that relief sits a quieter, more devastating reality. Fabio's daughters, two young women who lost their father in the most violent way imaginable, and who, even after the verdict, continue to believe their mother is innocent. At sentencing, Jessica Cimentelli stood to honor her father's memory while still holding fast to that belief.
My dad was our pillar of strength, steady, present, full of wisdom. He taught us how to be brave, how to be kind, and how to show up for the people we love. He taught us to climb our mountains, no matter how steep, like this one right here. I miss him every goddamn day. I think about him constantly. I know how lucky I was to have a dad like him. He was the best dad anyone could ask for. I have to remind myself that it's better to have had him and lost him than to have never had him at all.
Jessica's words offer a glimpse of who Fabio was inside the walls of their home. But for the rest of Fabio's family, the reality has been far harder to reconcile. The possibility that the man they loved was betrayed, not by chance, not by chaos, but by the person he trusted the most. And that betrayal, according to Fabio's nephew, is what finally made everything else make sense.
Monica Cimentelli, the woman Fabio trusted most, his wife for over 20 years, helped orchestrate his murder for money, lust, and freedom from a man who had done nothing but love her. I truly believe Monica resented Fabio, not for what he had done wrong, but for what he had accomplished. She envied the attention he received, the success he built, and the respect he earned. Rather than be proud of her husband, she was jealous of him. In her mind, being married to Fabio kept her in the shadow. And so she sought validation elsewhere, reinventing herself beside a man who was a convicted sex offender, a former adult film actor, and a racquetball instructor. That betrayal from wife to conspirator is something this family will never recover from. She showed no remorse. Instead, she manipulated her children, her friends, and the public. She did this not only to escape justice, but to continue chasing a fantasy life of luxury. She betrayed not just Fabio, but her daughters and stepson. She left them without a father, and worse, with the lie that her mother had no role in it. In doing so, she shattered our family's bond and created a divide that still lingers today. We lost more than Fabio that day. We lost their peace, our sense of family, and our belief that those closest to us can be trusted. We lost a light in our lives, a man who deserved so much better.
And now I'd like to introduce the podcast, Combat Fuel.
Hi guys, it's Alex from Combat Fuel here, the UK's number one military-owned supplement company. And we also have a podcast on YouTube and Spotify where we talk through military guys and girls, service and elite level athletes. What makes us unique is, for myself being an Afghanistan war veteran, my perspective is somewhat different to others. It's really interesting to see where people come from, the different walks of life, how they perform, how they act, why they join the military, what was their call to serve, and ultimately some of the guys that have had really harsh injuries, such as the triple amputee Mark Ormerod, all the way through to guys that have gone and jumping out of a balloon at 10,000 feet in the air. And they also did 100 rope climb to get there. It is unique, it's different, and we hope you enjoy watching it.
Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to early release and ad-free episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe in Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to watch our Thursday release episodes between the madness, you can find them on YouTube and Spotify. To find us on all social media platforms, search The Minds of Madness. And finally, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.
I'm a sinner, I've done bad things. Left scars where love should sing. I hurt people, I break dreams. I'm the shadow tearing at the seams. I wear a smile, but it's a disguise. Ordinary people do unthinkable lies. Minds of madness, twist and turn. Hearts on fire, let them burn. I'll seduce you, take it all. Watch you crumble, watch you fall. Minds of madness, whisper sweet. I'm the devil.